Well, this is Bill Rupp on High Tech Radio, and I'm doing an interview tonight. And this is a first for our interviews in a couple of respects. First of all, it's the first time I've had a chance to interview the author of a book. Secondly, it turns out that the author of the book has the same last name as I have. And that's not too hard to understand since he's my brother. And I'm going to let you, introduce his name and the title of his book.
My name is Thomas Rupp, and the book is Rockne and Jones, Notre Dame, USC, and the Greatest Rivalry of the Roaring Twenties.
And if people listening to this don't know what we're talking about, why don't you tell us who Rockne and Jones were?
Knute Rockne was the coach of Notre Dame from the late, I think he's, his, if I remember right, his first year, 1918, till his death in 1931, and Howard Jones was the coach at USC from 1925 until his death in 1941.
Actually, that's true. Tell us the publisher as well.
The publisher is called Black Squirrel Books, which is the trade imprint of Kent State University Press.
And that is Kent State in Ohio. All right. I have a list of questions here, which I hope will elicit some intelligent remarks. I think they will. First of all, what was your inspiration for writing the book in the first place?
Well, I was just kind of a fan of college football and really kind of been a USC fan all my life. And as the internet started to grow and you had the fan sites that people started going on, you'd hear kind of arguments back and forth between USC fans and Notre Dame fans about certain things that happened over the years. And I just started looking into, you know, well, what really happened in this incident? What happened that year? And finding out about how the series started. And it just seemed so fascinating to me that I decided it would be a great story to tell in more depth than had been done before.
Well, that's kind of interesting because you didn't go to SC. You went to got a degree from Long Beach State, but we won't go into the details of this. Why I was a UCLA fan, and all the other guys in the family were USC fans, but that goes back before you were born.
It's like a barrel of apples. There's always one bad one in there.
Okay, let's see. Oh, how long did it take you to write the book? I mean, the book is what, about 300 pages?
That's correct.
How long did it take you to write it?
Well, the whole, including research and everything, was about 12 years, but probably about 2 years to write the book. It was kind of part-time working on it. So I would say just about 2 years for the actual, you know, book writing and production phase of the work.
Well, that brings me makes me think of another question. Actually, you originally wrote this as a screenplay, correct?
Correct. That's why, you know, when I say, you know, 12 years with research and everything, that there was quite a bit of that, you know, upfront work. And one of the things I should probably say about the research is that with the newspaper archives that are now available online, you can really research just about any subject and find, you know, wonderful detail. Back in that time frame, they had a lot more detail in the newspaper articles than they do today. So it would have been impossible to travel around the country to go to libraries to try to uncover all these newspapers, but they're readily available now to researchers and writers on the internet.
You know, that makes me think of yet another topic, the fact that your and my grandfather, we're some of the few people who could actually say we have a member of the family who was literally a secret agent. And thanks to the work, genealogical work that our mother did, one of the many binders that she left us contains many, many clippings extolling the exploits of William A. Glover, who was our grandfather. And I noted myself, boy, there's a lot of details in these newspaper stories. They must have thought people could actually read.
Yes, and it's funny because when you go to the newspaper archives that I mentioned and put his name in and a few keywords, some of those articles will come up. Not too many, but there are out there on the internet. And as you know, Bill just mentioned, the depth of detail is really quite something when you look at it from modern eyes.
Yeah, you'd think it was more like an article for a magazine than a news story. Okay, you mentioned the Black Squirrel Press.
Black Squirrel Books.
I'm sorry, Black Squirrel Books, books from Kent State University in Ohio. Generally speaking, did you get good, bad, indifferent reaction from different publishers?
Well, I have not been a writer before, so there was no kind of name recognition that way. And I had just responded or actually searched out again on the internet publishers or agents that were looking for that would accept book proposals, and Kent State University Press was one of them. And they were the ones that really showed the interest, and you know, I kind of worked with them, and I had some editorial input, and then went back and rewrote the book and submitted it, and they accepted it. It was the only new book for 2017 for Black Squirrel Books.
Okay, let's go. I've got a whole list of questions here. We talked a little bit about research, and you've spoken to that, that you all sorts of things are available now that weren't. Did you actually do interviews with various people?
Yes, I was able to track down the daughter of Coach Howard Jones. There are very few people left that knew him or played for him. But I did speak with a couple times with his daughter, and I found two different players that had played for Howard Jones in the late 1930s. It was a little after the time frame of my book, but it did give me a good insight into the character and personal habits of Howard Jones.
Right. I have another question about research. Were you able to get, I think the answer is going to be it's tough to do, game films from the 20s and 30s?
Yes, actually, Notre Dame has the entire 1931 game that I was able to get at a very nominal cost from them. It was recorded by MGM. They actually showed it in theaters after the game, which was kind of a typical practice back in those days.
I noticed that when you go to YouTube, you can get quite a few older things, but in some cases, they start the camera basically when the play has already started, and I keep thinking, gosh, I'd like to see more about what was the formation like, and you can't see. And this film you're talking about, do they actually give you a chance to see the full play develop?
Yeah, they show the shifting of the teams, and a guy named Raven Dyer, that was the kind of the beat writer of the LA Times of that era, narrates the whole game. And it's interesting because a couple of scenes were recreated afterwards, you could tell, but about 99% of it was shot there in South Bend.
Well, I think I'm safe in saying that since 1920, maybe before, but certainly since the 20s and 30s, most colleges have filmed their games. But I'm also have the impression that most of those films got thrown out.
Yes, I think there's a big difference between 1920 and 1930. You know, as the book kind of talks about, everything got bigger and bigger and more sophisticated. And I think a lot of the films, like for instance, the 26 game, the very first game, there's just a few, like a minute or two that was available from Notre Dame. And I think it's because they were cutting these things for newsreels, and it wasn't like they were necessarily recording the whole game.
Okay, how about, here's something too that I noticed. You have kind of recreation in your book of various scenes where you actually have people saying certain things. Now, to what extent did you just have to use your imagination to express what was implied somewhat obliquely, or were these actual quotes that people said, yeah, so-and-so said this after the game? How about that?
In the book, almost everything that is in quotation marks was taken from a newspaper report. So if I say that Howard Jones made some remark after the game, it was in a newspaper somewhere. Now, from my own experience being interviewed, sometimes I don't think they had recorders that, you know, they were probably taking notes. So the word for word may not be correct. Sometimes I saw different articles that had slightly different wording. The only time I ever sort of made up words or statements was something very simple, like, you know, Smith go in there for number 15 or something like that, that would be something you would normally, you know, expect someone to say. But otherwise, everything was actually taken from an article.
My feeling is that this is more of a general history book of the late teens and the 1920s than a straight sports book. I mean, you've got amazing detail in there about what was going on in the rest of the country and the world. if someone had not ever known anything about the history from, say, 1918 to 1930 of the United States, they'd probably get a fairly good idea of what was going on. You had an awful lot of historical context.
Yeah, I think on a couple of fronts there. Number one, I think as an author, I think you have to kind of assume that while football fans and so forth are going to be your primary audience for a book like this, you can't assume that everybody knows the whole back history of all these teams. So I tried to explain why Notre Dame had become so important to American Catholics. So there's a lot of that angle to discuss. The other thing is that I think the growth of college football was kind of an outgrowth of what was going on at the time. The new technologies of radio and
films, even.
Yeah, films, but even the improved railroads and that sort of thing that allowed the travel to be more readily accessible to these schools. You really can't talk about the football part of it without talking about the society. And also, I think between Notre Dame and USC, it's not like Long Beach State versus Cal State Fullerton or something like that, or Army versus Navy. There were two schools that were widely separated, that it was really the mania for football that the rivalry grew out of.
One aspect of the historical perspective that I noticed, you went into great detail about the KKK, the Ku Klux Klan. I have trouble saying that. And I knew before that it was really big in Indiana, which is where Notre Dame is, in South Bend, Indiana. But any particular reflections on why there was so much? I guess you felt that it was that important to the story.
Well, again, I think it kind of reflected the kind of anti-Catholic bias that was that was felt to one degree or another in a largely Protestant country. In that time, the Klan had had a resurgence. They call it the second Klan, because the first Ku Klux Klan had basically been abolished in the Reconstruction period in the South. But at that time, their view was not so much against, you know, African Americans, although that was clearly important to the Southern Klan members, but in places like Anaheim, where they took over the city government at that time, and as Bill mentioned, in Indiana, they took over the whole state government, basically. The emphasis was on other kinds of minorities, Jews, Catholics, that sort of thing, and the idea reflects our debate today of what does it mean to be an American? Can you be an American if you have allegiance to a pope in Rome and that sort of thing? So that's why so much is included.
Well, it makes me think of today, the evangelical Christians in this country are huge supporters of Israel. And that might not have been true 60, 70 years ago.
I think that's definitely true, especially Southern Baptist types.
By the way, you didn't particularly comment on that, but I'm just a reflection of my own.
Well, yeah, no, I agree that that's probably the case. Well, of course, you could also say there was no state of Israel at that time. It wasn't until 1948, so.
Yeah, but supporting Israel is kind of a statement,
right, in
current times. And correctly pronounced, it's Canute Rockne. And people should, who have any historical perspective at all, should know about King Canute, spelled C-A-N-U-T-E, who was, I think he was at one time in the 11th century, controlled England. And supposedly he tried to sweep back the waves with a broom. I also heard the story that he did that deliberately to show his underlings, look, there's a lot of limitations to our power. We can't just do things we want to do. Anyway, it should be Canute. And of course, Howard Jones. And both of them really died young. I mean, let's see, how old was Rockne? He was early 40s?
I'd have to do the math. I think that's correct, yes.
And Jones maybe 50?
Yeah, 50, 51, something like that.
So they both died young, Rockne in a plane crash, and Howard Jones, heart failure?
Heart attack, yeah.
Yeah. Well, this is totally speculative, but since you're the expert in this book, you can. I'm going to ask you anyway, how long do you think both of those would have continued coaching at their schools if they hadn't met an early demise?
Well, there was a lot of speculation that Rockne was reaching the end of his career. He had been coaching a head coach at Notre Dame since 1918. So it had been like a 12-year period. There really was nothing more for him to prove. He had won several national championships. And really, as historians say, he's created the modern coach. There's really not a Nick Saban without Knute Rockne back in those days. Plus, his health was an issue. He was going to become a vice president of the Studebaker Motor Corporation, a new car coming out called the Rockne, named after him.
Yes, I've heard of the Rockne, but it was only in this book that I realized that Rockne had health issues.
Yeah, and you know, there's some debate as to how bad it really was, but I think it was, my personal opinion is that he was probably reaching the end of his coaching career if he had not retired, let's say, after the 1931 season. I have a feeling maybe two or three more. Howard Jones is interesting. His wife had been committed to an insane asylum, or to an asylum anyway.
And that was his second wife. His first wife divorced him.
That's correct. And during the middle 30s, his teams had really fallen off, and there's a lot of newspaper articles I read. If you've ever gone, again, on the internet sites today for teams, any team that's lost a game, you know, everybody wants to fire the coach. They all thought Howard Jones had passed his prime. So I don't know how many more years he would have coached. Probably not. Well, once, you know, he died the same year as the Pearl Harbor attack that brought the United States into World War II.
That was before the 41 season, correct?
Right. It was in August, if I remember correct, of 41. Or earlier, maybe it was July. I'd have to check my own book.
But the main thing is, 40 was his last season.
Correct. Yeah, 1940 season. So, of course, World War II would have had a big impact on things. You know, Notre Dame and USC didn't play during the war years. You know, it's hard to say. Again, he was early 50s. You know, I'm going to guess maybe another 4 or 5 years he might have coached.
You also talk about, and this is very interesting when you think about the controversy over the importance of big-time sports and colleges. It's no new thing. Would Rockne, if he'd stayed another 5 or 6 years, and as you say, maybe he wouldn't have stayed that long, would he have been able to survive the pushback by the Notre Dame administration?
I think that might be something also. You know, he resigned several times over the course of his career at Notre Dame. Typically, it was kind of a negotiating ploy, but I really can't say, because the depression that had just basically started when he died certainly had an effect on what they were doing. I think if you look at the entire history of Notre Dame football, there's always a tug of war between the head coach and the administration. So it very well could have had a factor that he might have at least retired as a football coach and remained as the athletic director.
Well, I'm reminded of the fact that, who was the president of the University of Chicago? Chicago, in the very early days of the 20th century, was a big football power. And I can't remember his name now. You should. Anyway, he engineered the dropping of football at the University of Chicago after the 39 season. So there was a lot of controversy over that. I think the struggle has been now won by the football fans.
Well, I would say if you go back even before this period in the 1890s, that a lot of schools, USC, Stanford, I believe, and probably Cal, dropped football and went to rugby because they felt there was too much emphasis on these big games and the alumni coming back and, you know, rumors of players being paid off and stuff. And they eventually went back to football again. But as Bill said earlier, the struggle between academics and athletics goes back really from the very first kickoff.
I think we should, in all honesty, inform the listener that those weren't just rumors about payoffs to athletes. They were, in all too many cases, it was a true. Now, you talked about rugby, and you and I talked earlier about this, that up till through 1905, American football was very similar to rugby, in which it kind of derived out of rugby. Now when you put in the forward pass, then it starts to change. Even though before 1906 there was, you had to go so many yards and so many downs and so on. But that I thought was an interesting comment. That's not in the book, by the way, but interesting comment nonetheless.
Yeah, that's something I've been working on, an article for the Collegiate Football Researchers Association, which I haven't finished. And that's kind of my thesis, is that gridiron football, and I use that term because it includes Canadian football, although I don't think they legalized the forward pass, I believe, until 1925. But I think that's the point where American football really became no longer just a variation of rugby.
If you go to YouTube, there is a game from 1903, a few minutes of it. A lot of the minutes were showing the people coming on the field in the stands. A few plays. I think it was Princeton versus Rutgers. I can't remember now. But there is that. And unfortunately, it was taken from ground level. But it looks like just two masses of humanity crashing against each other. And that was 1903, before that big change of this forward pass.
Yeah, and then, of course, they had the mass plays of flying wedge and all that that caused horrendous injuries. And the story's pretty well known with Teddy Roosevelt bringing the Ivy League administrators in. And that's what kind of helped drive some of these rule changes that resulted in the American game of football.
Hey, here's kind of a factoid type question, but I was wondering about it. I think you probably mentioned, and I just forgot. Where did USC play before the LA Coliseum was built?
They had different places that they played. Bovard Field, I think, on campus was one place.
Isn't that the practice field now?
I'm not sure that the current Bovard Field is this. No. They called it Howard Jones Field, but there is a Bovard Field there, but not 100% sure. Again, as Bill said, I didn't go to USC. Not 100% sure it's the exact places where they used to play.
Yeah, you do mention a figure, a character named Bovard from the history of USC.
And there was a couple of them, actually, that were related. And I'd have to check the relationship. But like the same thing with the Rose Bowl. They used to play at a place called Tournament Park before they built the Rose Bowl Stadium.
USC and Notre Dame have for generations been among the top football schools. Which became big time first, USC or Notre Dame, or was it more or less at the same time?
Notre Dame, for sure. You know, they really kind of got on the map when Rockne was a player in 1913, and they upset Army, and they had used the forward pass really kind of for the first time as a sophisticated weapon. And at East Coast bias at that time kind of ended, you know, the western border of the New York State was, and anything past that, they didn't know what they were doing.
So. Well, the Big Ten was originally called the Western Conference.
Right. And in point of fact, USC kind of wanted to emulate Rockne and Notre Dame's football success to bring money into the school, which they were not the only school to do so. And even on the West Coast, they were the little brothers and late to the conference compared to schools like Stanford and Cal.
Well, Cal was a big, and I guess maybe Stanford as well. They were big time in the very early 20th century, correct?
Yes, and the predecessor to Howard Jones, Elmer Gloomy Gus Henderson, was brought in. He was a high school coach in the Pacific Northwest, and he was brought in to kind of bring USC's football up, and he rubbed those guys the wrong way, and there was acrimony between the Bay Area schools and SC, and they severed relations for a while. So.
Gosh, they get along so well now.
Yeah, it things.
That was a joke.
Yeah, I know, but I'm saying more things change, the more they stay the same.
That's right. Listen, I want to talk about the last chapter, which I found particularly interesting. You didn't, and I would have liked to have seen it. Coaching records for the two men.
I don't know. I didn't think of that, to be honest with you. I mean, as I was writing the book, the College Football Data Warehouse was readily available, and you can get those records. Since that time, it's kind of on hiatus, so it's a little more difficult. But
I've used that site a lot, and the archives through about 2014 or 15 are available, and this new rebirth of that site seems to be kind of in limbo itself. And the other thing that I would have liked to have seen, and I know it's not absolutely critical, it would have been kind of fun to see a list of the scores of the entire series.
Yeah, again, something that really hadn't occurred to me. But
if you had only asked, I would have told you. Wait a minute, you did ask, and I didn't tell you.
I will say that I think I exceeded the number of pages that they had originally kind of blocked out for this book. So
yeah, having done some writing myself, I understand their publishers' reasons for that. This last chapter I found especially interesting, and I'm going to let people read the book. We'll talk about it a little bit, but it doesn't have anything to do directly with Knute Rockne and Howard Jones. Two people very different in personalities, by the way.
Yes, that's correct. In fact, you would think that based on the personalities that Rockne would have been the USC coach and Howard Jones would have been the Notre Dame coach, because Howard Jones is a much more conservative individual than Rockne was.
The last chapter basically is a rebuttal about someone who made a statement regarding some critical part of the origin of the USC Notre Dame series. And without going into too great a detail, why don't you just give us a little bit of information on that?
Well, there's an old story of how the series came about. It's detailed. It's been detailed before. I detailed it again in the book. And the professor from the Midwest, Indiana University, if my memory serves, wrote a book several years ago, kind of deconstructing the Rockne myth, because most people, what they do know about Canute Rockne comes from the 1940 film Canute Rockne All-American, which, by the way, Howard Jones appears in. But in any event, that film doesn't talk about the USC-Notre Dame rivalry. But this particular story is a very interesting story, been told by people who are one of the persons at USC from back at that time. This professor's book basically made the argument that couldn't have happened, that was just a matter of money. And I spoke to one of the daughters of the individual who told the original origin story. I looked at every source I could find. I actually found some good Daily Trojan articles at that time period. And basically, the professor's is an anti a big time college sports person. I think that's fair to say. And I think he just basically dismissed it because he wanted to dismiss it. And he felt he's very cynical, I would say. And I tried to make an argument. I couldn't prove that this particular story happened, but I tried to lay out sort of a court case to say that all the circumstantial evidence together shows that it was at least more likely than not that it did happen.
Well, the fact that you included that chapter at all indicates that you think it's important to try to rebut that. By the way, is that guy still alive?
I believe he is. I think the reason why I did that is because a lot of sources now, if you Google all this on the internet, you'll get a lot of older articles, especially out in the West Coast. It's the whole line about if a story's too good to be true, you know, tell it anyway, because don't let a few facts get in the way of a good story. But other sources will say that this individual has pretty well disproved it and stuff. But I really went to pretty great lengths to show that I think he's on pretty shaky ground to discount it 100%.
In other words, fake news.
Kind of. You know, again, I can't prove everything from the story, but I think, you know, if you look at the totality of the evidence, I think that, like I said, if I wasn't a jury, you know, I'd vote not guilty or guilty or whichever way you want to put it, that it did happen, because it would really require individuals at the time to just basically be making stories up. And that's the biggest thing, I think, that's kind of hard to believe.
Well, it's kind of hard to prove anything 90 years after the fact. You have to go with what information you have. Well, we've been talking with Thomas Rupp, my brother, and his book is Rockne and Jones. And it is subtitled Notre Dame, USC, and the Greatest Rivalry of the Roaring Twenties. It's published by Black Squirrel Books from Kent State. And by the way, Kent State is in Ohio, and neither in Indiana nor California. So, well, that's kind of a factoid.
However, Howard Jones was from Ohio.
Oh, okay, that's right. Anyway, and I can tell you, having read the book, it is I'm impressed with it. The scholarship behind it is really great, and it's a history book. It isn't just, as I said earlier, it isn't just sports. It's about the whole world of the 1920s, well, into slightly into the 30s. And Tom, thanks a lot for talking with us, and I hope you will write another book.
Thank you very much for having me, and I'll see what I can do.
Okay, that's Thomas Rupp and his book, Rockne and Jones. Another high-tech radio interview. This is Bill Rupp. Thanks for listening.